From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. Puerto Rico's new governor has been in office just 9 weeks, and he's dealing with several crises, from the pandemic to the ongoing recovery from Hurricanes Irma and Maria in 2017. This week, however, he's on Capitol Hill to build support for another priority, statehood. House lawmakers introduced a bill on Tuesday that could allow for Puerto Rico to become the 51st state. And Governor Pedro Pierluisi joins me to talk more about it. Governor, welcome.
Hi, Callum. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Likewise. And I want to start with the statehood bill being introduced by Democratic lawmakers, New Mexico's Martin Heinrich in the Senate and Florida's Darren Soto in the House. A majority of Puerto Ricans did vote in favor of statehood in November. So do you think this push in Congress has a shot?
Definitely. We had an up or down vote on statehood. That type of vote had never been done in Puerto Rico. And we did it against all odds. Congress had made no commitment or any kind of offer to Puerto Rico before the vote. And the U.S. Department of Justice in the Trump administration objected to the vote. We had our general elections, and statehood got more votes than any candidate for office. Now the ball is in Congress's court. And I have no doubt that when the time comes, a majority of the members of the U.S. House of Representatives will support statehood for Puerto Rico.
Governor, listeners might gather from your response that you are also in support of statehood. So why is that? What would it mean for Puerto Rico to become a state?
What we're asking for is basically equal rights. We've been American citizens now for more than 100 years, and we continuously face disparities in the way key federal programs work on the island. This is like geographic discrimination. If you move to Puerto Rico, automatically you lose rights. You will have no congressional representation with a vote. You will not be able to vote for president or vice president. And you will not be eligible for programs such as supplemental security income. The Medicaid program in Puerto Rico works very differently than in the states. You will not get the same type of access to nutrition, to the SNAP program, nutrition assistance, and I can go on and on.
But Governor, could it be possible to address some of those current concerns through other channels? Because Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for example, who is probably the most prominent member of Congress who's of Puerto Rican descent, is skeptical of statehood. I mean, she wrote an opinion piece for NBC last year arguing that statehood is arguably, quote, the culmination of colonization. How do you respond to that?
Well, the way this will work, it's not Congress imposing its will on the people of Puerto Rico. It's going to be very different. This would be Congress saying to the American citizens of Puerto Rico that they can have equal rights so long as they vote for statehood in a congressionally sanctioned referendum. Doesn't the majority rule in a democracy? The majority has spoken in Puerto Rico twice. The same should apply to the Congress.
Governor, let me just ask you one other political question then about statehood, because Republicans are concerned about this idea. In fact, Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, warned his party last year that admitting Puerto Rico would essentially create two new Democratic senators in perpetuity. I mean, do you think that's accurate? And how would you get Republicans on board? Because you'd presumably need at least 10 GOP senators to break a filibuster.
Yes, I know. And it'll be tougher in the Senate. The first thing that I have to say is that it's not correct to assume that once Puerto Rico becomes a state, it'll elect two Democratic senators and four Democratic representatives. Not necessarily so. Anybody who has lived in Puerto Rico knows that there's a considerable sector of our population that is quite conservative. We haven't been participating in the American electoral process, so they will not necessarily align with one party or another. They will be voting for the candidates that have the best commitments to Puerto Rico, like any other place in America. If anything, Puerto Rico could be viewed as a swing state.
Governor, I do want to get to a couple of things besides statehood. I know that last month, a federal control board reached a deal that would have reduced Puerto Rico's debt by about 80%, but you rejected it because it also would have made cuts to pensions. So what happens now? Do you see a way forward that does resolve the island's public debt problem, but doesn't cut into public services or pensions.
Yes, I do believe there's a way forward. Actually, the government of Puerto Rico already reformed the principal public pension system on the island, drastically reformed, freezing benefits, changing it into a defined contribution system as opposed to a defined pension benefit system. And we did that before the board was around. I support the proposed plan of adjustment that the oversight board will be submitting to the federal court with the support of about 70% of the Commonwealth's creditors. I support the economic terms of that plan, but I will not support pension cuts. And they're not necessary, and they shouldn't have been included in the plan, and that's going to be my posture before the court.
That's Governor Pedro Pierluisi of Puerto Rico. He was previously the island's attorney general and its non-voting delegate in the U.S. Congress. Governor, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Former members of the Trump administration are speaking out about a decision to quietly divert $10 billion earmarked for hospitals struggling with the coronavirus pandemic. The money was meant to help healthcare providers pay for things like staffing and personal protective equipment. Instead, it was allocated to contracts for Operation Warp Speed to aid with vaccines. Rachel Kors has been looking into what happened with that money. She's a Washington correspondent for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Rachel, welcome.
Thanks.
You know, there is still a lot we don't know about what happened here, but what have you been able to uncover so far?
Yes, that's true. I uncovered that last summer, Operation Warp Speed was running out of money. And this was in the middle of a contentious, you know, debate over stimulus funding. And it was right before the election. So Trump administration officials decided to use $10 billion, as you said, from a fund for hospitals for Operation Warp Speed contracts, and they used a financial maneuver that allowed them to spend the money without notifying Congress that they were using it for a different purpose than was originally intended.
Remind us about the goals of Operation Warp Speed, and did we get anything out of it?
Yes, Operation Warp Speed was a program to help with the development, manufacturing, purchasing, and distribution of vaccines and therapeutics. And I think there are certainly people who would argue that it was a very successful program. I mean, we do have three vaccines developed in record time that are being shipped out across the country right now. So I think there's certainly a recognition that this effort was successful. I think there is some, you know, controversy over what, you know, how much Operation Warp Speed specifically contributed to us having the vaccines that quickly. But I think overall, the program was certainly considered a success.
It appears that this action to move around money wasn't illegal, but you could say it fell into a gray area. What's the nuance in how this was carried out?
Well, lawmakers had, I think, realized that the pandemic was, you know, an emergency and that the health department would need flexibility. So they gave them flexibility in one of the COVID relief bills that created this fund for hospitals and healthcare providers. But in order to, you know, use that authority, the health department would have had to notify Congress that they were going to use funds for a different purpose. But they chose not to do that. Instead, the top internal lawyer at the health department decided to give them permission to just spend the money directly out of hospitals' fund, which allowed them to spend the money without notifying Congress.
Okay, so four former Trump administration officials actually shared this information with you anonymously. What kinds of reactions are you getting to your reporting?
I think some people are saying that, you know, there was a lack of transparency and officials shouldn't have been moving money around and not telling anyone. But others are saying that this $10 billion was a very impactful investment in vaccines and therapeutics. And, you know, vaccines and drugs are available sooner that help reduce hospitalizations than, you know, the costs that hospitals are incurring on the front end actually go down. So it maybe was a good use of the money.
What are you hearing from hospitals about the need for funding?
I think hospitals are saying that they're getting money very slowly, and the health department has really only compensated them for kind of the early days of the pandemic. So they've gotten some money for like the first two quarters, like the first half of 2020, but they haven't gotten any funding for, you know, COVID hotspots since last July. And we saw this huge increase in hospitalizations at the end of 2020 with this wave that we saw kind of during the holidays. So I think their argument is that hospitals have not been compensated for the losses that we've seen more recently, and so that the money should be directed toward that.
Okay, so how will this actually impact the Biden administration and how it deals with hospital funding going forward?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Now the Biden administration is kind of faced with unwinding what happened during the Trump years, figuring out how much money is actually left in this fund to give out to hospitals and healthcare providers, and kind of just figuring out where the money went. And there's also a discussion on the Hill now of whether providers should get more money to compensate them for the money that was spent on these warp speed contracts.
Rachel Kors is Washington correspondent for our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you for your time.
Protests continue in Myanmar, despite the deaths of more than 30 people killed by security forces during yesterday's demonstrations. The death toll is the highest since the protests started at the beginning of February, when the military ousted the elected government of leader Aung San Suu Kyi. The BBC's Jonathan Head is following this story from Bangkok, and he joins us on Skype. And Jonathan, let's start with what happened yesterday. Why were so many protesters killed?
I think because the security forces have escalated the use of lethal force. We've seen it used since the coup less intensively than it was yesterday. But there was quite clearly, from the video evidence that we've watched and from talking to people who were on the streets, there was no attempt by the security forces to minimize loss of life. In one case, we actually saw police summarily execute an ordinary man they just detained. They shot him in the back and then dragged his body away. This is, even by the standards of this region, is a completely callous disregard for human life. But it may well be calculated in an attempt to try to terrorize people off the streets, because, you know, we're more than a month into this coup and the military has still not got anywhere close to suppressing what's become a national uprising.
Right. People still are willing to risk their lives. I mean, protesters, largely women, they aren't showing any signs of fear. They were out on the streets again today. What are the demands?
The demands are the same as they've been all along, which is a restoration of the democracy which had survived for close to 10 years in Myanmar. In particular, the reinstallation of the government led by Aung San Suu Kyi. It did win an election by a very decisive majority back in November. As far as ordinary people are concerned, this is a brazen attempt by the military to turn the clock back, to retake the power that they had for decades in Myanmar, and to undo the democratic experiment which they initiated a decade ago. And people aren't having it. And many of the younger people who are out there are saying, look, you know, we've got used to the freedoms that came with this opening. We've got used to free access to the internet, being able to express ourselves freely, to be connected to the rest of the world. They're terrified that if they don't stop this coup now, when it's still uncertain, it's an unfinished coup at this stage, then they will be cast back to the terrible days of isolation and military misrule that their parents and grandparents experienced in the 1970s and 80s. So, you know, despite the deaths, they feel they've got no choice. They've got to come out. And there's also an element of disillusionment because there's so little practical international support. Lots of expressions of outrage, but at this stage, no sign that there's any international plan to come in and help them.
Mm. Can you talk about the significance of the young people who are out on the street and the women who are out on the street? We're reading stories of female volunteer workers who are patrolling the streets, tending to the wounded and the dying.
This is a younger generation that is exposed to the rest of the world and has pretty progressive ideas. Younger women in particular see no reason why they should take a backstage. And they're borrowing their ideas very much from what we saw in Thailand in the anti-government protests at the end of last year, and in Hong Kong as well. A youth movement that mobilizes through social media borrows a lot of the sort of dress sense and the ideas about how you can resist military rule, you know, building improvised barricades, dealing with tear gas. And these young people, I think, see themselves as part of a broader generation in Asia that wants to demand the same freedoms that you get in the Western world.
Jonathan, this is a major crisis. What you're telling us is a doubling down from the military. Is there any sign that the military is going to give up power? What are you watching for now in the next few days?
It's terribly grim. I don't think there's any doubt now but that to say that the Burmese military, with its mindset, is a poison with no concern whatsoever for the lives of the people that it now governs. And it makes it a difficult institution to deal with. There are only three ways out of this. The military continues its massive repression in the hope that it terrorizes people back into their homes, or that there are some kind of cracks in the military. But we've never seen that before. It's a military that keeps itself apart and it never shows disunity. Or there's a compromise path out. Now, talking to people like the UN Special Envoy, Christine Schreiner-Bergener, who has to go in, was trying to go in at the moment, that's their best hope. And it will require an extraordinary degree of coordination. Otherwise, I'm afraid we're on a path to terrible repression and a great deal more lives lost.
The BBC's Jonathan Head speaking with us from Bangkok. Thank you so much.
Good to talk to you. Thank you.
Though films like Black Panther and Cat People have made them famous, actual black leopards are rare, and their coloring makes the nocturnal creatures extremely difficult to photograph. But in 2019, wildlife photographer Will Berard Lucas traveled to Kenya and managed to scientifically document the black leopard in stunningly beautiful photographs, most captured at night using special technology he developed. He's now published a book that showcases some of those photos and tells the story of his journey into wildlife photography. It's called The Black Leopard, My Quest to Photograph One of Africa's Most Elusive Big Cats. It's out this week, and Will Berard Lucas joins me via Skype to talk about it. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Will, I have to say your book helped clear up my confusion about leopards versus jaguars versus panthers. You explain that what we call black panthers can be either black leopards or black jaguars. Whatever the name, what causes their unusual coloring?
Well, it's basically a gene, a bit like how you might have an albino. You can have a melanistic leopard or jaguar, and it just means that it's got an excess of this dark pigment. And so in leopards, if it gets the gene for melanism from both of its parents, then it can be black.
I see. And I have to say, one of the most striking things about the creatures is that if you look very closely, you can actually see that they do still have the spots. They're not pure black. There are slight color variations across their coats. You say that they are hard to find. I mean, where are black leopards most commonly found?
Leopards themselves range throughout Africa and Asia, and mostly it seems the highest prevalence of black leopards is in these thickly forested areas, such as in Thailand, Malaysia, and India. And this is probably because a black leopard in a dark, gloomy forest is going to sort of blend into the shadows and actually maybe even have an advantage over other leopards when it comes to stalking prey in those sort of conditions. But then in somewhere like Africa, particularly the area I was working in, Laikipia, where it's quite sparse, shrubby savanna land with lots of pale grass, there a black leopard as a cub would be very vulnerable because it'd be easy to spot things like baboons and other enemies of leopards would easily spot a black cub. Plus, when it's trying to stalk its prey, particularly if it's, you know, there's strong moonlight or during the day, it's very easy to see. And so in those places, it would make sense that that gene doesn't really provide any benefit to the leopard. And that's why it's probably much rarer in places like Africa.
But these were just sort of rumors and anecdotes, right? Because the black leopard hadn't actually been scientifically documented in Africa for about a century. So what brought you to Africa to take a shot at doing what hadn't been done in so long?
Until the point of this project, you know, there had been photos of black leopards, snapshots that had been captured by the side of the road and things. But yeah, no scientific research or documentation of them. And so I heard through a friend of a friend in the tourism industry about, you know, there was a black leopard sometimes being seen in this area. And so I followed that lead to the landowner on whose land this leopard was being seen fairly regularly. And it turned out that there was also some leopard scientists from San Diego Zoo who had also followed the leads via a different route to this leopard. And they'd actually been there compiling a scientific paper about this leopard. And so when I got there and started to get my photos, we decided to kind of join forces and use my photos to help illustrate their release of their scientific findings. And so through my partnership with them, when my images were released in conjunction with their scientific paper, it was the first time that, you know, a black leopard had been documented scientifically in Africa.
And it took some innovation to pull this off, right? You used a couple of innovations, something called the Beetle Cam, and another called the camera trap. Could you explain how those work?
Yeah, certainly. So the first device I created was Beetlecam, which is a remote control camera buggy, and I stuck a high quality DSLR camera on top of it. And I could use that to position my camera down in front of animals and get this intimate, close-up, wide-angle perspective. And that worked really well for some of the bolder animals like lions and elephants. But with shy animals, you know, the moment they saw this remote control buggy moving towards them, they turned and ran away. They're pretty much programmed to avoid anything unfamiliar that lurks in the grass. So I had to come up with a different way to photograph them. And so that's when I started to use camera traps. And a camera trap is basically a stationary camera which you can set up next to an animal trail. It's a normal high quality camera like you would use, you know, any photographer would use. But then I've got a separate sensor which will detect when an animal passes. And as soon as an animal passes, it will trigger the whole setup and take a photo. And so through this project, I had between 5 and 8 camera traps running for more than a year to get the pictures that then went into the book.
Wow. You have these great images that you've captured. It must have been thrilling to take the camera out of the trap and see your work preserved there forever. And yet you also write beautifully about the fleeting moment of just seeing a black leopard with your own eyes, something that only you will remember. I mean, how do those different thrills compare?
For me, just being out in these wild places is what I derive the most pleasure from. And so photography in some ways is a vehicle through which, you know, I'm able to do that. But yeah, certainly then being able to inspire other people to sort of see the beauty in some of these places and some of these animals and hopefully inspire them to care a bit more about them is obviously also very rewarding.
Wildlife photographer Will Berard Lucas's new book is called The Black Leopard, My Quest to Photograph One of Africa's Most Elusive Big Cats. To see some of his photos, go to hereandnow.org. Will Berard Lucas, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
The news is about more than what just happened. You need to know why it happened, who made it happen, how it's felt in the communities you care about. NPR's daily news podcast, Consider This, gives you all of that, with context, backstory, and analysis on a single topic every weekday. It's not just information, it's what the news means. Consider This from NPR.
The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, along with Russia, is meeting virtually today to consider increasing oil production to 1.5 million barrels a day. After tanking last spring, oil prices have been rising in recent weeks to pre-pandemic levels. That usually means a drilling frenzy and a lot more oil being pumped. But U.S. oil producers have actually been under pressure to keep production down. And as NPR's Camila Domonoski reports, that pressure is coming from a surprising source: oil investors.
Why would oil investors want less oil? Well, over the last decade, the fracking revolution sent U.S. oil production skyrocketing. Investors poured money into the industry, even after a price crash in 2014. They thought that investment would pay off, but
the people that came in and put money to work in 2016 got burned.
Dan Pickering is the chief investment officer of Pickering Energy Partners. The thing about the oil market is the more oil that's for sale, the less each individual barrel is worth. And companies with all that Wall Street money went a little overboard. They just pumped more and more and more. They made a lot of oil, but not a lot of money. And that was even before the pandemic crisis.
It was a very challenging time period to own oil and gas assets.
The shale revolution made America the world's biggest oil producer, but that boom in oil was a bust for profits. So now?
Investing for the sake of growth is not what investors want. Growth got us more barrels, it got us too many barrels, it got us low prices, it got us weak returns.
Less oil, more money per barrel. That's what investors are pushing for now. That is, if they're investing in oil at all.
Many of the investors have left with a bad taste in their mouth and are not going to come back anytime soon.
Manas Satapathy is a managing director at Accenture Strategy, a consulting firm. He says a lot of major investors are tired of giving oil companies money with nothing to show for it, and they're worried about climate change. Those could be separate concerns. Even if investors were seeing big profits today, they could worry about environmental issues. But for the last few years, short-term profits and climate concerns, they've been pushing in the same direction. Scott Stringer is the New York City comptroller. He and a board of trustees manage one of America's largest public pension funds. And the city recently pulled $4 billion of those pension funds out of fossil fuel investments.
The data doesn't lie. These are not investments that will grow a pension fund potentially.
Stringer says the fund takes a long view, so it's not just about oil's recent performance. But analysts say those dismal returns can make it easier for investors to walk away. So on the one hand, you have big funds pulling out of oil. And on the other hand, the investors who remain are pushing for less oil and more profit. That's putting pressure on the oil industry not to go wild. But oil companies like to drill for oil. It's kind of what they do.
The fear is that companies start throwing all their money into growing.
Rebecca Fitz is with Boston Consulting Group's Center for Energy Impact.
It's the issue to watch over the next year.
Everyone is waiting to see, as oil prices go up and up, if the oil industry's newfound sense of restraint will stick around. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
We want to look now at a persistent question that remains unanswered a year into this pandemic. Why do so many people die from COVID-19 in some countries, but not in others? More than 518,000 people have now died from COVID-19 in the U.S., but in India, the recorded deaths have been less than a third of that, even though the population is about four times as large. Similarly, South Africa has been hit hard, but in Nigeria, the recorded deaths have been lower than expected. Doctor and Pulitzer Prize-winning author Siddhartha Mukherjee has been trying to solve the mystery. He's got a piece in this week's New Yorker. Dr. Mukherjee, welcome.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So you spoke with a number of researchers, epidemiologists, who generally expected that death rates would be astronomical in places where a lot of people live in poverty, in close quarters, with poor sanitation. And yet that's not necessarily what's happened. So what did you find?
Well, in some ways, it's the opposite of what's happened, although there are exceptions to the rule. What's happened is that there's a kind of a geographical patchwork. Places like India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, places like Vietnam and New Zealand have suffered comparatively few deaths. Nigeria is another example, Cote d'Ivoire, Ghana, and places like Belgium and Spain and Italy and the United States and the United Kingdom, where you have very mature healthcare systems, have suffered an enormous amount of deaths. I mean, if you look at, you know, typical diseases, malaria and typhoid, it's always, you know, low-income countries get badly hit and high-income countries are relatively spared. And in COVID, although that's not always the case, you know, there are exceptions to this, Peru being one of them, South Africa being one of them, it's as if the paradigm has been reversed. And so that's the mystery. Is it because these are younger countries by median age? Is it because they're underreporting their deaths? And that's the conundrum, the COVID conundrum.
Well, let me ask you about some of these theories, right? Because there are some thoughts about what might explain why the world seems kind of upside down in this regard. One, as you said, is that, well, maybe these countries are just underreporting their COVID deaths. And you report that that may be true and sometimes significantly in some places, but that doesn't fully account for the disparity in death tolls. But what about age, which you also mentioned? I mean, the median age in a country like India, for example, is much lower than in some of the European countries. I mean, could that be part of the explanation?
It could be part of the explanation, but it can't be the entire explanation. The simplest analogy that I can give you is Mexico. The median age in Mexico is nearly the same as the median age in India.
And yet Mexico is really suffering the worst edge of COVID. And similarly in Peru and other places. So although places like Italy and Spain have almost 1.5 times or twice the median age as India, so India being about 28, Italy and Spain being about 45, 46, it cannot be the only answer, because then how do you explain Mexico?
All right, let me run another idea by you then. What about government responses? Here in the U.S. and some other places, mask wearing, for example, became a political issue, and there's been some resistance to that, as well as social distancing. Maybe that was just less true in some other places. Could the government response account for the differences?
Certainly, we've seen that there have been places in the world where the government response has been extraordinarily tight. Quarantine was imposed early, and there was a widespread acquiescence to the government responses. I'll give you two examples, very different from each other. One would be New Zealand. It can quarantine more easily because it can monitor whoever's coming in and whoever's coming out. And New Zealand's done very well, to some extent, similarly for Australia. But take a country like Rwanda, much poorer, but also very strong government response, partly learned from previous pandemics. You know, I spoke to people who work in Rwanda, Bethany Hett being one of them from Harvard Medical School and Partners in Health. And she said that, you know, the Rwandan response was extraordinary. They did a lot of contact tracing. They did not make a political issue of mask wearing. And I mean, any day, this could change any day. A new strain could completely change the dynamics of this pandemic. But all of this said, these countries have done very well because of the concerted and spirited government response.
So some of these countries, as you say, had experience confronting past diseases. And I'm glad you brought that up, because is it possible then that their citizens maybe had been exposed to a virus that was somewhat similar to COVID-19 in the past, and maybe they had built up some immunity in advance of this pandemic? What about that theory?
The evidence that we have is still, I would say, mixed. The surprising piece of evidence first emerged from Shane Crotty and Alessandro Setti's lab in La Jolla, where they found that patients who were not exposed to COVID-19, but were exposed potentially to other viruses, including other related coronaviruses, didn't have antibodies against COVID-19. You wouldn't expect them to. But they had T cells against epitopes or pieces of protein in COVID-19. That study has been replicated in multiple laboratories, that there is some prior immunity that is protecting people from the worst ravages of COVID-19. In other words, they get the infection, but the infection fatality rate, the number of people who die if you get an infection, regardless of the age, is much, much lower. And that's a fascinating idea, but it's really been underexplored because we need much more detailed studies to understand whether that idea is true or not.
So what I'm hearing, Dr. Mukherjee, are a bunch of partial answers or possible answers. Did you come away with a conclusion, a leading theory for you about why some countries are impacted so differently from others? And do you think that we'll ever know the answer with some certainty?
Well, there are two camps. One camp thinks that there will be, as we dig deeper, that there will be a unifying answer. And indeed, it might be true. But I belong to the second camp. I don't believe that there's going to be a single answer, but a patchwork of answers. And it cannot just be government response, because the government response in different countries was different. It can't just be the aid structure, because again, compare Mexico versus India. It can't be just human genetics, because Indians in the United Kingdom have been disproportionately affected than Indians in India. So there must be a patchwork of explanations, and we need to be humble about proposing single big answers to these major epidemiological questions, as opposed to proposing that every individual country may have had particular vulnerabilities that would explain why that country did well or badly in terms of COVID deaths.
And so the mystery continues. Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee's piece, trying to answer some of these questions is in this week's issue of The New Yorker. Dr. Mukherjee, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Many of us have been reflecting about where we were this time last year. It was when some of us realized we would be required to work from home in order to stem the spread of COVID-19. And Callum, what do you remember about this time last year?
Boy, Tanya, you know, I remember it was a very disruptive time for my family. You know, my wife and I have two biological children, and we're also foster parents, and we were caring for a three-month-old baby. And just a few days before the station sent most of us to go work from home, we'd gotten a call about an eight-month-old. This was a baby we had cared for in the past. She'd gone back to her bio mom for a while, but that didn't last. And we just couldn't bear the thought that she was going to go to another unfamiliar home. So we took her back. And so just as the pandemic was hitting, we were figuring out life with two babies and four kids all together. And it was a challenge, to say the least. But you know what, Tanya? Now I'm actually really feeling blessed to have spent so much of the past year at home with my growing family.
What a time for you and your family, Callum. You know, I was hosting out of NPR West in Culver City, California, and out of an abundance of caution, NPR asked that I leave the building because my producer and I had been in contact with someone who had been in contact with someone who tested positive for the virus. And we were all learning in real time how this virus was spreading. You know, what strikes me about that moment is that we really understood the gravity of it, but we had no idea the devastation that lay ahead. And I'm sure a lot of you out there remember that feeling. We've all lost so much, but we want to know, what are you reflecting on this past year? What memories of coming together or working together in those early days are you reflecting on? Tell us by sending us an email to letters@hereandnow.org. Did you know this day, March 4th, used to be Inauguration Day? And the last time that happened was 1933, when Franklin Roosevelt took the oath of office during the Great Depression and said these famous words.
So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
On March 4th, 1865, as the Civil War was drawing to its bloody close, President Abraham Lincoln uttered his own famous words, now etched on the walls of the Lincoln Memorial. Here and Now's Alex Ashlock produced this story about that day last year, and we are rebroadcasting it today.
I think this is his greatest speech, and it's a kind of a spooky, strange speech.
Edward Acorn is the author of the book Every Drop of Blood, The Momentous Second Inauguration of Abraham Lincoln.
They're on the brink of saving the country from being destroyed. And instead of having this great celebratory speech, he talks about all the suffering that that war engendered was God's just punishment for the sin of slavery.
Randy Duncan, who often portrays Lincoln, reads the president's words from March 4th, 1865.
It may seem strange that any men should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. But let us judge not, that we be not judged. The prayers of both could not be answered. That of neither has been answered fully. The Almighty has His own purposes.
In the crowd listening that day, the actor John Wilkes Booth, an ardent supporter of the Southern cause. Acorn says Booth thought Lincoln was a tyrant who had to be removed, and he would kill the president just a few weeks later.
He got a pass into the Capitol building, and he used that pass to slip in behind Lincoln when Lincoln was walking out to the platform, and somebody apprehended him. God knows what would have happened if they hadn't.
The poet Walt Whitman covered the inauguration for the New York Times.
He wrote more about the setting of the speech, which makes me wonder how well he heard it. But he wrote about a cloud over Lincoln's head like a bird of peace. And he wrote about the sun coming out. And he wrote about being able to see Venus up in the sky. And he thought all these things were quite poetic statements that this suffering was finally coming to an end.
Frederick Douglass, the famous black abolitionist, was also at the Capitol for the inauguration. As Acorn writes, Douglass had disparaged Lincoln as devoid of anti-slavery conviction. But on this day, he heard Lincoln condemn slavery as a grave sin that caused a civil war.
He came to understand that Lincoln was a statesman who had to time his actions to what the public would accept. And I think that's a very poignant thing to see at the end. He's there at the speech, standing out in the mud because they wouldn't let African Americans into the Capitol building for the ceremonies. And then he went to the White House that night, and the guards tried to throw him out because he was African American, and he persisted and got in to the reception. And Lincoln said, "Oh, here's my friend Douglass." And Lincoln was thrilled to see him and asked him what he thought of the speech.
Douglass told Lincoln it was a sacred effort. The response pleased the president, who wasn't religious but had clearly spoken in biblical terms in a speech that ends with these words:
"With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations."
To me, that is a message that we cannot lord it over each other. We cannot be self-righteous. We cannot look at the Southerners as treasonous, who deserve to be punished for this. We have to bind up each other's wounds. And that's an extraordinary thing to say, because while he was saying those words, General Sherman was in South Carolina virtually raping the state to force the South to surrender. There were many people who wanted the South to pay a deep price. They wanted Jefferson Davis and Robert E. Lee strung up and hanged for sedition. And Lincoln had a different approach to that, and I think he had a sane and more pragmatic approach.
And more charitable.
I think the level of horror of that war called for charity at the end of it.
For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
Yes, we'll rally round the flag, boy. Rally once again. Shouting the battle cry of freedom.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now.
Shouting the battle cry of freedom.